My name is Nikki Strong, and this is VOA 1. The hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today, Gregory Stockel has a report on how activists in Mexico are helping American women get access to abortion medication. Dan Novak presents this week's education report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first, here is Gregory Stockel.
Marcela Castro's office in Chihuahua is more than 150 kilometers from the United States-Mexico border. But the distance does not prevent her from assisting women in the U.S. to go around the recent bans on abortion, a medical procedure to end a pregnancy. Castro and her co-workers work for Maria Verde Chihuahua. The organization of mostly volunteers has supported reproductive rights in northern Mexico since 2018. They provide virtual guidance and abortion pills for women who want to end a pregnancy on their own. Their abortion model requires no travel, health center visit, or prescriptions. It was developed by Mexican activists through many years of facing abortion bans and restrictions in Mexico. The organization does not charge for the help they provide. And the model gained interest in the U.S. as the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade to end the constitutional right to abortion last year. Castro and her co-workers are trained acompañantes. They can safely advise women on self-administered medical abortions, and they serve as a guide and partner in person or from a distance. They have studied national abortion guidelines, and they fully know the medical procedures established by the World Health Organization, or WHO. We don't offer medical attention because we are not doctors, Castro said. Although it is a medical procedure, it does not require hospital measures. Most women from the U.S. contact Maria Verde Chihuahua through social media or are introduced by someone. Most communicate in Spanish, though the acompañantes could also assist English speakers as well. Communication usually is conducted via a mobile and secure tool, WhatsApp. In most cases, medication is advised, and the acompañante provides a combination of two drugs, misoprostol and mifepristone, to end the pregnancy. They are both considered safe by the WHO and the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. The work of the acompañantes troubles anti-abortion activists in Mexico. One of them, Jael Torres, of a national group called Pasos por la Vida, suggested there were health risks because abortion pills were given by non-medical workers. However, The WHO's guidelines show self-administered abortion as a safe option. John Seago is president of Right to Life in the U.S. state of Texas. The organization is pushing for new legislation to punish those breaking Texas law by helping people receive abortions. He said there has yet to be any strong effort to bring legal action against those involved with supplying abortion pills to people who live in Texas. Texas simply does not have enough policy tools to efficiently stop these practices, Seago said. Nathan Cortez is a professor of health law at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas. He said he expected that women in states with abortion bans would consider getting help from outside the U.S. Las Libres is an organization founded 20 years ago in the Mexican state of Guanajuato, where abortion is still banned. It is led by activist Veronica Cruz, and it began training acompañantes since 2019. In January 2022, we had an average of 10 cases every day. When Roe was overturned in June, we had up to 100, Cruz said. She said the numbers kept rising until they reached 300 requests per day, all from the U.S. The workload was so large for her team of 10 people, so she created new networks to help. In 1 year, we created more than 20 networks. We are about 200 people helping only the United States, Cruz said. I'm Gregory Stockel.
An elementary school shooting in the U.S. state of Tennessee recently left 3 9-year-olds and 3 adults dead. Now, state legislatures across the country are moving forward with bills aiming to improve school safety. The bills have been introduced in both liberal and conservative states. Some bills would require schools to put in place technology like panic alerts, security cameras, and emergency communications systems. Lawmakers see the bills as a way to improve school security while avoiding the dispute over gun control. But some experts say teacher safety training is more effective and less costly than the new technologies. Democratic state lawmakers have called for tighter gun laws to prevent school shootings. But many are now also supporting the school emergency measures that have largely been pushed by Republicans. In the northwestern state of Oregon, Democrats control the legislature. A bill there would require schools to send electronic warnings to parents as soon as possible after a safety threat. It passed the State House of Representatives with support from all lawmakers. 2 Democratic lawmakers are the main writers of another bill that would require all public school classrooms to have panic alert devices. They would contact police or other emergency services when used. If passed, the panic alert bill would make Oregon the 4th state to pass the law. Florida, New Jersey, and New York have all passed it. Several other states are considering similar legislation. Panic alert devices started being used more after the 2018 mass shooting at a high school in Parkland, Florida. Lori Aladeff's 14-year-old daughter, Alyssa, was among the 17 killed. She started the group Make Our Schools Safe and began supporting panic devices. She had texted her daughter as shots were fired that help was on the way. "There is really nothing to lose by being prepared," said Lori Kitty Gorodsky, the group's spokesperson. Some Republican-led states have approved more money for school safety to help schools pay for new devices like panic buttons. Crisis Alert, for example, costs at least $8,000 per school for a 3 to 5 year contract, said Will Fullerton. He works for Centigix, the company that makes the product. After a shooter killed 19 children and 2 teachers last May at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas, state officials announced $105 million for school safety and mental health programs. Nearly half of that was given for bullet-resistant protection for school police. $17 million was for school systems to purchase panic alert technology. The Missouri House recently approved a 2024 budget with $50 million for school safety funds. That is on top of the $20 million already approved for school safety in the current year. Schools will be able to use the money on technology, including door-locking devices, communication systems, and video surveillance equipment. Ken Trump is the president of National School Safety and Security Services. The group advises schools on safety measures. He said lawmakers often make one-time purchases of new technology, but do not fund the technology over longer periods of time for things like repairs. There's no budget to repair, replace, and maintain them after they put them in, Trump said. He said the tools are often not properly used. He added that schools should center on training teachers to identify and recognize dangerous situations and make thoughtful decisions under stress. I'm Dan Novak.
You just heard this week's education report presented by Dan Novak. Dan joins me now to talk more about his story. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks, Ashley.
There are many mass shootings in the United States. There was just one the other day in Kentucky. How many mass shootings have there been already this year?
Mass shootings are uniquely American tragedies. And there have been 145 mass shootings in 2023, where at least 4 people were shot and injured just through April 11th. That is according to the Gun Violence Archive, which records shootings around the country.
And how many school shootings have there been?
Education Week says there have been 14 school shootings with at least 1 injury or death this year. And there has been 158 since 2018. 111 people have been killed in total, and 289 injured. It's kind of hard to wrap your head around some of these numbers.
Your story centers around the school safety measures that states are passing, like requiring panic alert buttons and other technology. You note that both conservative and liberal lawmakers support these laws to make schools safer. You also say that passing these laws permit the lawmakers to avoid the dispute over gun control. Can you explain what you meant by that?
Sure. As any American knows, guns are a very divisive topic in U.S. legislatures and the U.S. Congress. Democrats largely support passing more gun control measures to try to prevent gun violence. Republicans say mental health measures must be passed, and largely oppose any limits to gun ownership. There have been many efforts over the years to pass some kind of gun control, and little progress has been made. So, lawmakers may see these safety bills as a way to make schools safer without the political risk of trying to pass gun control and failing.
Well, thanks again for that report today, Dan, and thank you for joining me on the program today.
You're welcome, Ashley.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Bob Doty with Steve Ember. We continue the story of the administration of Herbert Hoover, and we talk about the election of 1932. President Herbert Hoover worked hard to rescue the American economy following the crash of the stock market. It happened in October of 1929. Within a month, Hoover called the nation's business leaders to the White House. "Don't lower wages," the president told them. Hoover called on the bankers at the Federal Reserve to make it easier for businesses to borrow money. He tried to provide funds to help farmers get fair prices for their crops. He pushed Congress to lower personal taxes. And above all, the president urged Americans not to lose hope in their economy or in themselves.
But the economy was in ruins, falling faster with each passing day of the crisis that grew into the Great Depression. The value of stocks had collapsed. Millions of workers lost their jobs. The level of industrial production in the country was less than half of what it had been before the stock market crash. Hoover's efforts were not enough to stop the growing crisis. In ever greater numbers, people called on the president to increase federal spending and provide jobs for people out of work. But the president was a conservative Republican. He did not think it was the responsibility of the federal government to provide relief for poor Americans. And he thought it was wrong to increase spending above the amount of money that the government received in taxes.
The situation seemed out of control. The nation's government and business leaders appeared to have no idea how to save the dollar and put people back to work. Hoover was willing to take steps like spending government money to help farmers buy seeds and fertilizer. But he was not willing to give wheat to unemployed workers who were hungry. He created an emergency committee to study the unemployment problem. But he would not launch government programs to create jobs. Hoover called on Americans to help their friends in need. But he resisted calls to spend federal funds for major relief programs to help the millions of Americans facing disaster.
Leaders of the Democratic Party made the most of the situation they accused the president of not caring about the common man. They said Hoover was willing to spend money to feed starving cattle for businessmen, but not willing to feed poor children. Hoover tried to show the nation that he was dealing with the crisis. He worked with Congress to try to save the banks and to keep the dollar tied to the value of gold. He tried hard to balance the federal budget, and he told Americans that it was not the responsibility of the national government to solve all their problems.
Late in 1931, President Hoover appointed a new committee on unemployment. He named Walter Gifford to head this committee. Gifford was chief of a big company, American Telephone and Telegraph. But Gifford did Hoover more harm than good. When he appeared before Congress, Gifford was unable to defend Hoover's position that relief was the responsibility of local governments and private giving. He admitted that he did not know how many people were out of work. He did not know how many of them needed help, or how much help they needed, or how much money local governments could raise.
The situation grew worse. Some Americans began to completely lose faith in their government. They looked to groups with extreme political ideas to provide answers. Some Americans joined the Communist Party. Others helped elect state leaders with extreme political ideas. And in growing numbers, people began to turn to hatred and violence. However, most Americans remained loyal to traditional values, even as conditions grew steadily worse. They looked ahead to 1932, when they would have a chance to vote for a new president.
Leaders of the Democratic Party felt they had an excellent chance to capture the White House in the election, and their hopes increased when the Republicans renominated President Hoover and Vice President Charles Curtis in the summer of 1932. For this reason, competition was fierce for the Democratic presidential nomination. The top candidate was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the governor of New York State. Roosevelt had been re-elected to that office by a large majority just 2 years earlier. He came from a rich and famous family, but he was seen as a friend of the common man. Roosevelt was conservative in his economic thinking, but he was a progressive in his opinion that government should be active in helping people. Roosevelt had suffered from polio and could not walk. He used a wheelchair, although it was rarely shown in news pictures.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt's two main opponents were Al Smith and John Garner. Smith had been the governor of New York before Roosevelt. Garner, a Texan, was the Speaker of the House of Representatives. Together, they hoped to block Roosevelt's nomination, and they succeeded the first three times that delegates voted at the Democratic nominating convention in Chicago. Roosevelt's chief political adviser, James Farley, worked hard to find Roosevelt the votes he needed at the convention. Finally, Farley found a solution. he made a deal with supporters of John Garner. Roosevelt would make Garner the vice presidential nominee if Garner's forces voted to make Roosevelt the presidential nominee. Garner agreed. And on the next vote, the Democratic delegates nominated Franklin Roosevelt to be their presidential candidate. Al Smith was so angry about the deal that he left Chicago without congratulating Roosevelt. Roosevelt wanted to show the nation that he was the kind of man to take action, that he had more imagination than Hoover. So he broke tradition and flew to Chicago. It was the first time a candidate had ever appeared at a convention to accept a nomination. And Roosevelt told the cheering crowd that together they would defeat Hoover.
The main issue in the campaign of 1932 was the economy. President Hoover defended his policies. Roosevelt and the Democrats attacked the administration for not taking enough action. Roosevelt knew that most Americans were unhappy with the Hoover administration. So his plan during the campaign was to let Hoover defeat himself. He avoided saying anything that might make groups of voters think he was too extreme. But Roosevelt did make clear that he would move the federal government into action to help people suffering from the economic crisis. He said he was for a balanced federal budget, but he also said the government must be willing to spend extra money to prevent people from starving.
Americans liked what they heard from Franklin Roosevelt. He seemed strong. He enjoyed life. And Roosevelt seemed willing to try new ideas, to experiment with government. Hoover attacked Roosevelt bitterly during the campaign. He warned that Roosevelt and the Democrats would destroy the American system. But Americans were tired of Hoover. They thought he was too serious, too afraid of change, too friendly with business leaders instead of the working man. Most of all, they blamed Hoover for the hard times of the Depression. On Election Day, Americans voted in huge numbers for Franklin Roosevelt and the Democrats. Roosevelt won 42 of the 48 states at that time. The Democrats also gained a large majority in both houses of Congress.
The election ended 12 years of Republican rule in the White House. It also marked the passing of a long conservative period in American political life. Franklin Delano Roosevelt would become one of the strongest and most progressive presidents in the nation's history. He would serve longer than any other president, changing the face of America's political and economic systems.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.